Maybe you should mind your own business.
You know, I'll tell you, I've tried. But it turns out I'm really bad at it.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 341 for the week of February 8th, 2021. I am Magic Stakeout Camera David T. Cole, and I'm here with Convenient Crazy Wall Sarah D. Bunting.
Even the string is evil.
Dead Hacker Tara Ariano.
As far as the government knows.
And Evil Tech Titan Adam Sternberg.
I wear blazers with sneakers!
Welcome to Extra Hot Great. Joining us once again, our old friend Adam Sternberg. Hello, Adam!
Hello!
Yay!
Thank you for having me.
We're so happy to have you for this very important conversation about CBS's remake of The Equalizer. Distinct from the film franchise of The Equalizer that stars Denzel Washington, which Dave and I have seen both of them because we like trash.
So have I.
The new show premiered Sunday after The Big Game, as I think legally we are required to call it. As in the original, the titular character is a retired intelligence agent who's now a righteous vigilante on behalf of the downtrodden and hopeless of New York City, with the assistance of her old contacts and their various useful skills and laissez-faire attitude toward the law. But whereas the original series in the 80s starred Edward Woodward, a white-haired British guy, as Robert McCall, this time our protagonist is played by the comparatively youthful and vivacious Queen Latifah, and she is Robin McCall, a lady. That's right. So before we get into it in detail, let us quickly go around the circle, do the Chen check-in. Adam, very briefly, should our listeners watch The Equalizer?
No.
Okay. Sarah?
Yes.
Okay. Dave?
No.
Okay. I think they should too. Interesting split. Let's get into it. Adam, you came in hot on Saturday when I promoted this very podcast appearance on our Twitter account saying there you said there is and will only ever be one Equalizer, and you posted a picture of the original.
Wow.
Edward Woodward. Now that you've seen the remake and we've already heard your answer, apparently you still feel that way.
Well, I not only watched the pilot episode of the new Equalizer, but I rewatched the pilot episode of the old Equalizer from 1985 with Edward Woodward as Robert McCall. I did watch this. I don't know. I have to say, at this point, watching network procedurals for me is sort of like watching a three-camera sitcom with the laugh track. Mm. Like, I just can't get past how the format feels so outdated. The show itself was fine. Let me say that. I mean, The Equalizer is kind of a hard premise to mess up because it's not just the premise of two movies with Denzel Washington and a whole other successful TV show, but it's like the premise of every action movie ever made.
Right.
It's like a person who doesn't play by the rules, who's going to like get the job done, even if they have to bend the law a little bit and they're helping the little guy. The one thing I was a little, and Queen Latifah is very charming, and I think she's actually a perfectly logical person to cast in a 2021 reboot of The Equalizer. Mm-hmm. The one thing I was missing a little bit in the show was not a super hacker character, because he's in the show.
Right.
The lovable Adam Goldberg.
Yes.
Still working. But I wondered if at some point the show will introduce some sort of tension or some dilemma at the core of her character. Like, basically in the pilot, she's just a really nice person who also happens to be really good at fighting, who beats up the bad guys with very little difficulty, and then sends the young woman who is her charge off to her interview for a scholarship, and then kind of winks at the camera, and then that's the end. So I kept waiting. I mean, as a sort of hour of like state-of-the-art network procedural CBS drama, I guess it's fine, but I felt like it was lacking a little bit of the kind of, dare I say, frisson of the original series, which I can talk about a little bit more like later. But like the whole idea of The Equalizer was that there was this kind of tension between this character who sort of to steal the Liam Neeson line, which is from his own version of The Equalizer. Taken is like he has this special set of skills, right, and he's employing it to help the little guy because the powers that be, you know, are either out to lunch or incapable of helping people anymore. But when the original Equalizer came out, it was at this moment when, like, you could portray, for example, New York City as a cesspool of out of control violence and crime.
Right.
So there was sort of a reason, right, for this character to exist. Like, the Guardian Angels were a real thing that existed in New York at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And this show didn't try to update that.
Queen Latifah's closing Bank of America locations all over the city.
Yeah, it just was like, she lives in New York. She seems to have a nice apartment. She completely coincidentally stumbles into this woman's dilemma, and then she saves her with very little trouble. So I'm not sure where you go from there. If that sounds appealing, by all means, watch the show.
Well, in terms of the tension, I'll just say, I mean, the original part of it seemed like part of the what Robert McCall was working off was like his guilt about what he did when he was an intelligence agent, like, you know, shady shit in Chile or South Africa. And like, if this show, you know, has her grapple with that, like there's hint touches in the pilot about an op that went wrong in Venezuela where it's like, ooh. So if they try to get into like, the CIA is maybe not a force for good in the world, I will be impressed by that. I don't necessarily believe that's where they're going
to
go.
Yeah, but to Adam's point, yeah, like the most sort of display of power that the forces of not good have is like they're really good at manipulating a video and creating a deep fake. Like,
yeah.
That was the one thing where they, wow, that was really good. And like, we're really in it now.
Mm-hmm.
But everything about confronting the people involved with that was just very much the John Wick can do anything mode.
Sure.
And we're decades away from Die Hard and how Die Hard works so well because the protagonist was flawed and could be shot.
Yeah.
You know, he was in danger. And even though you knew at the end of the movie he was going to make it, mm-hmm, they really sold it along the way that he was in peril, yeah, all that time.
Yeah.
And that's what made it exciting. And they need to introduce that sort of thing into, yeah, a show like this where the premise is the Equalizer is helping people whose backs are really up against the wall and with forces, you know, beyond their ability to combat.
Yeah.
They don't sell that.
Right. For the counterpoint, let us go to Sarah D. Bunting. What did you like about this?
Well, look, I will say that, you know, this is nothing you haven't seen done before. We have Leverage. We have Blind Spot. We have the original Equalizer. Like, this is not new. And I can't necessarily tell anyone to, like, clear your schedules to watch it live. Like, I won't be doing that. But here's the thing. There is a place for this kind of material. And with this particular group of people, it's like they just went up to the like Buncey guarantee board and started mashing it and then poured a bunch of bullet bourbon on it and like then creamsicles and kittens. Like, okay, guys, like Shambhala.
Mm-hmm.
Shambhala Green is in it. It's like a Law and Order reunion. I love it. I love me some Goldberg. My notes say I want to dance from Dazed and Confused. Like, I was just happy to see these people all working together. And then like Noth does an origami like note drop and then they meet at the Wonder Wheel. Like, you know, you don't even have to take me to dinner. I'm in. But that's like a, you know, that's a pretty specific set that is designed to get me to watch it. But it did remind me of Blind Spot also in the way that like it's almost not the plot is almost not the point. Like you're just wanting to spend time with these actors,
right,
as these people, which is good because this is a CBS procedural. So it is not really going to be challenging law enforcement. Like this is a cop show and they can sort of try to perform. They could try to perform a sort of like sensitivity or broadness in terms of their approach to law enforcement. But I suspect that in the executive suites, they feel that by casting people of color, their work there is done. And I'm not sure where it's going to go in that regard. But I, you know, this is a deeply conventional network, and this is a reboot of a fairly conventional show. So it's outstanding hotel TV. And there's a place for that. But, I mean, you know, Dave and Adam aren't wrong. There's nothing new here. There's nothing groundbreaking. This is exactly like the procedural with a laugh track. That's totally right on. But I enjoyed it. I will note, it was very piloty with some exposition, is yes. A. B, do not put Jonathan Adler light fixtures in a diner in Queens where there's going to be a shootout. Like, I'm like one of three people who's going to be like, oh yeah, those, they're like 300 a pop. But as it happens, very distracting. But that's a very minor note. I found this enjoyable, but you know, it's a CBS procedural.
It is, but also I feel like they're trying to like do something somewhere between a CBS procedural, like everything else on that network, but also like half of it is trying to be the first half of a Mission Impossible film, like not the big set piece at the end, but that first one, you right. know, with the whole team working together to find a way to get the girl out of the back of the van and that kind of stuff. It's mm-hmm. very, you know, Tom Cruise, Ving Rhames et al. Working together.
Yeah.
But sure. everything is working on that TV network level where it is like, okay, I see what their inspiration was, but it kind of falls flat. The hacker with the giant, useless 16-panel monitor that is displaying credit card numbers at random sizes all over it, like it makes any sense whatsoever. This hacker who has an abandoned subway station underneath a bar as yeah. his office.
Yeah. As we all do from
and
time
it's
to time.
Like, got designer furniture all over it. Yes, somehow his desktop is littered with files. Like, he's got the worst digital hygiene of any hacker. Mm-hmm. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, I didn't find it unenjoyable. I should say that. Like, watching it, it was sort of hitting all the expected notes that you would completely predict it to hit. But there was a part of me that was like, why would I ever want to watch this as opposed to just watching Extraction on Netflix or some other, you know, like there's so much more action fare in the world.
Yeah.
And I do feel like the show is going to have to figure out what the kind of hook is other than the name recognition of the franchise, because mm-hmm. I feel like to Sarah's point about sort of network procedurals, it always seemed to me that we're kind of at the point where you need some sort of thing of like, he's a con man, so he's got special con man powers, or he yeah, can tell when right. people are lying, or she's a former magician's assistant, so she can fit into any space. Or like, and with Queen Latifah, she really is just like the most sort of bland action hero, punch, punch, kick, kick, like no one can stop her. And the way they explain it is like, well, CIA, which also feels just weirdly sort of anachronistic because we've spent so much time over the last 4+ years sort of learning about how the CIA actually works in the world and yes. how little of it is like people who are wet ops expert kung right. fu people.
Yeah.
So, you know, is it possible that the ensemble cast could sort of gel into a charming like group of rascals, like in a Mission Impossible? Sure, maybe. I also like Adam Goldberg quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But there was a way that the whole thing had this like designer imposter perfume vibe to it. Like when the scene where mm-hmm. she goes, like, first of all, the villain is a evil tech guy who like wears a blazer and sneakers and his name is Reese Quinn. And literally his first line is, "Welcome to the future."
Oh,
and you're like,
God,
this is
I
like
know.
A computer generated villain.
Yeah.
And then there's a scene where she's like somehow gets in the car with him, which doesn't alarm him particularly. And then she gets out and she's got like a little thing in her hand that's just like, I've cloned his phone. Don't ask too many questions. And now she can listen to his phone. Like there's gadgets and there's stuff going on, but none of it feels like tethered particularly to an actual relatable, not even a reality, but just like a sort of world that feels interesting in the way that like John Wick is all about the world of the story.
Right. Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I agree with Sarah that Dave and Adam aren't wrong, but also that this is like right on the line of enjoyable enough in the PI aspects of it that are sort of fun. Like, I liked seeing her. She's just fun to watch to me, and seeing her get to take on different sort of guises, because she does have the range. Like, we know from watching her many variety of roles that she's taken on over her career, like, to see her get to, like, pretend to be a public defender and pretend to be a driver and, like, call up and pretend to be from the health department to this private club, like, that's sort of fun. And the prospect of getting to see her do more of that sort of master of disguise stuff is, I think that is appealing.
Yeah, I mean, if they go that route and they make her more assured and confident and can inject a little more sort of humor and levity to her character,
right,
like, that goes to the side where she is sort of the John Wickian can do anything.
Yeah.
But then you play that up where she's cool as a cucumber all the time and she's going to solve it, you know it. It's just a question of how she's going to do it, right?
Right.
And the other side is right, the vulnerable John McClane side, where you have to do things like make the action scenes a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
It is sort of like it was a TV version of Bourne, and not because they wanted to ape the style so much. I think they were just hiding the fact that there's a 50-year-old woman trying to do action scenes.
Yeah.
But they didn't do it well.
Yeah.
You can, but they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You could make the argument, though, that, like, I found that sort of relatable. Like, you could sort of see Queen Latifah, like, laboring a little bit. And I'd found that, like, not compelling, but, like, I was okay with it. Because she, I mean, the character is, like, supposed to be retired. Like, she is, you know.
Yeah, but they're trying to hide 50. It. So I don't think that was the intent.
Maybe.
No, I don't either. And right. I think that they should play that up more. Just let her be huffing a little bit. Like,
yeah,
it's
fine.
Absolutely.
Like, if Queen Latifah shows up and is like, I am, you know, taking control of the situation over from you, like, I don't care what the situation is or whether she's even this character, I'm going to be like, yep, you got it.
Yeah, totally.
Handle it. I've felt that way for 30 years and I don't think I'm wrong.
Yeah. I would like to see more Lorraine Toussaint. I did not love seeing her trapped in the house for the whole episode, but...
Yeah, really. But on the other hand, you know, if the check is good, good for you.
True.
It's time to go around the dial talking about things we've been watching lately. Tara, what do you got?
Well, since Adam was here, I felt obligated to watch something from his employer. Just kidding. It was just a coincidence. I watched The New York Times Presents Framing Britney Spears.
Oh my God, Adam, do you work for Britney Spears?
Adam has been a backup dancer for Britney Spears for many years. No. The New York Times Presents is a documentary series on FX. This is the first episode I've watched because I am trash. Also because I just read the article in last month's Vanity Fair, which I will link to, about Britney Spears's increasingly controversial conservatorship. So for those who don't know, in 2008, a court ordered that Britney's estate had to be handled by a conservator on the basis that she was not capable of handling her own financial affairs. She'd been seeing this guy named Sam Lefty, and the argument went her family was concerned that she was going to be susceptible to fraud, meaning he was going to steal all her money. And so Britney's father, Jamie Spears, was named her conservator, which legally meant that if any entity wanted her to do any work, like an album or an arc on How I Met Your Mother or a residency in Las Vegas, they wouldn't contract with her. They would deal with him. And again, this was in 2008. So if we all cast our minds back to that time, we may recall various tabloid reports of what was going on with her at the time. That was when she shaved her head. She was hospitalized. There was speculation about drug abuse. She was in a custody fight with Kevin Federline and losing it. But more than a decade has gone by since then, and in that time, fans have started to raise questions about why this conservatorship is still in place. And not just fans, also the ACLU. So conservatorships are usually it's a legal instrument that usually is for people that have, like, serious mental impairments. It's generally a situation that no one ever gets lifted. And it's similar to, but not exactly the same as, if you recall, New Yorker readers, that article from a few years ago about guardianship for senior citizens, where it's like a similarly kind of little understood situation where, like, people get into it and then they don't know how to get out. And, like, there's a very little oversight, and the people that are handling, often strangers, like, financial and legal affairs, like, don't, like, can just completely bankrupt them and there's no oversight. It's a bad situation. So the documentary first places Britney Spears in historical context, and it covers her rise as a celebrity from a very young age, how she was positioned, how completely disgusting, like, the coverage of her was in the press.
Oh, God, yeah.
Basically, how she never had a chance at happiness or a normal life. Like, would show her on talk shows with people where it's like, let's talk about the subject everyone is on everyone's mind. Your breasts. Like, an interviewer saying this to her face when she was, like, a teenager. And I have to say, I was guilty of this, too, as a commentator on pop culture had a celebrity website. Like, you know, due to internalized misogyny and so forth. And I did it too. But in recent months and years, my thinking about how young female stars are in the public eye has changed. And I have to say, in part because of 90210 OMG, because in every episode, even though that podcast is mostly trash, they get into like what it was like to be under that kind of scrutiny as a young teenager and a woman. And, like, how it's hell and no one was protecting them. And just, like, that was very much on my mind, too, watching this documentary. Like, the similarities between her situation and theirs, Jenny and Tori. So the documentary, I have to say, elides a little bit how the hashtag Free Britney movement started from, like, wild conspiratorial speculation that actually alighted on something real. Willa Paskin was tweeting, as we're recording this last night, about how, like, no, fandom online is still mostly, like, a cesspool, and it's basically indistinguishable from QAnon. This one just happened to be real, like, about something real. But it's a bracing couple of hours that will make you want to find Jamie Spears, Justin Timberlake, Diane Sawyer, the paparazzo who claims he did not know Britney Spears wanted to be left alone, the former photo director of Us Weekly, line them all up and shoot them with a harpoon. So it's on FX. I strongly recommend it. It's really well done. That's my highbrow pick. Lowbrow, Married at First Sight, season 12. They're back 12. In Atlanta.
Oh, my God. How? Yeah.
They're back in Atlanta where a couple of early seasons took place. This is the first season shot entirely during the pandemic. Not that you'd know it. The pandemic started a few weeks into season 11, which ended up making that season about twice as long as they normally go because no one knew it was going to happen and they were all locked down, obviously. So once again, we have five couples. Once again, I am asking you, Married at First Sight, go back to three. This is too many. It takes me so long to learn everyone's names. Like, I was texting about the show with Stephanie, past and future guest, on the weekend, and I referred to Victor, and she was like, Vincent? Like, yes, that's who I meant. Anyway.
I have a similar problem with Life After Lockup, AMA.
So, I think when I talked about the show last season, it was still too early for me to have gone all in on Bennett and Amelia, who were the two weirdos. But as the season went on, they fell in love with each other, and I fell in love with them. They are so cute. And I think the reaction of the show's producers and experts to that success has been, we're never going to top that match, so we are not going to try ever again. And now we're just casting for drama. So there's one couple who seem normal, the aforementioned Vincent, not Victor. The second most likely to succeed are Ryan and Clara, who are getting along well. Their issue is his parents are both pastors, and she's, like, not with organized religion. And then we have two couples who are mismatched in similar ways. Virginia likes to go out and party a lot. Like, she seems drunk at the wedding, not the reception, at the vows. And he's a total homebody whose big scandal is that he's divorced. He's also a pilot. He would love to tell you about it a lot.
Boy.
But this may be good for their prospects because that means he's away 4 days a week, which would allow her to go out to clubs and EDM festivals and whatever other shit she likes to do as the single person she still wants to be, clearly. And then we have Jacob and Haley. She's another one who says in all her intro materials that she's very independent, has a happy life as a single person. Like, why are you getting married? But she likes to go skydiving and travel. And his big hobbies seem to be improving his house, working out, eating nothing but steak and eggs for every meal. So Jordan Peterson vibes, yikes. And talking about these three subjects exclusively. There's really funny editing on him boring her and everyone in her family at the wedding about this. Finally, Chris and Paige. He is such a red flag factory. There's no explanation for his getting through the screening process except he was cast explicitly to ruin some nice woman's life. He starts doing that immediately. He's been engaged to someone else in the same calendar year as his wedding on the show. He tells her bridesmaid this at the reception. He also tells them in the same conversation he's not attracted to Paige. Meanwhile, his whole family's telling Paige how she should conduct their sex life. The day after the wedding, he goes downstairs to get, like, breakfast menus and just never comes back. Eventually, hours later, returns. And then he tells her he's not attracted to her. He really had to, like, think about it for a while. And she's like, that's weird because we had sex last night multiple times. So
did
then the producers make...
Did he bring breakfast back, though?
No. And then...
Like, that's the red flag to me. Like, you better be back here with some eggs, bitch.
Seriously. So then she still has to go have lunch with his shitty family to, like, learn more about him, which she either gets out of doing or else she's like, you're not sitting down with my parents. Sorry. Unclear. And then producers talk her into sticking out the process and going on their honeymoon. Poor Paige. But from the super tease for the season, we find out there's another bomb coming from Chris, which seems to be that he got some other broad, I hope it's his ex-fiance, pregnant. So great job, experts. I don't know how they keep getting people to be on it and trust the clearly flawed process, except no one who is on each successive season seems to have ever watched the show before. But yeah, amazing show. Love it. For my plugs.
Oh my God.
I reviewed The Equalizer at Primetimer, and I was on Sarah's other podcast, Quaid in Full, the podcast about the entire career of Dennis Quaid. We, the two of us, or Sarah and her co-host Jeb Lund and our past and future guest John Ramos, all talked about Postcards from the Edge. So we will link that in the show notes. It was so much fun. Love that movie.
Oh, thank you. It really was a delight to have you, of course, and hopefully you'll be back.
I would love to.
Adam Sternberg.
So here's what I've been watching. One of our many pandemic viewing projects, we've been rewatching many episodes and seasons of The Great British Baking Show, or The Great British Bake Off, as it's known in Britain. And it's sort of become our nightly comfort food, and we're totally okay with that. But because we've been steeping in that particular broth, we started watching the show that now like gets thrown up on the Netflix algorithm for us all the time, called The Big Family Cooking Showdown, which is also British and also involves cooking and people showing down. Have any of you watched this
Nadia
show?
Nadia was the host of that, yeah?
Nadia was the host in season one. And so we started watching it. Also, it's kind of fun to watch with our daughter because it's sort of about families cooking together. But for me, I can't exactly recommend it, but it's actually kind of fascinating to watch because there's two seasons of the show, and the first season is such a disaster that season they got rid of the hosts, they changed the judges, they changed the format of the show, and they changed the setting. So basically everything about the show was tossed out, and they kind of like rebooted the entire thing for season two. So in season one, they have two hosts. One of them is Nadia Hussein, who was the winner of a Great British Bake Off season and is extraordinarily charming. And I left this show to go host a different BBC show. The other host is Zoe Ball, who's one of those kind of like strange British presenters, in quotes. Who and then there's two judges. One is Giorgio Locatelli, who's a Michelin-starred chef, as they remind you at every opportunity. And a woman named Rosemary Schrager, who is some sort of like British cooking expert teacher personality. She's been on other cooking shows on the BBC. And the premise of The Big Family Cooking Showdown seems on paper like it should be really successful. They have sort of trios of family units. Sometimes it's like three sisters or two parents and a child or a grandmother and two kids or whatever. They come on, two families face off like Family Feud style, and they have these rounds where they have to cook like their home cooking, with the idea of the show is like the family kitchen is where love happens. It's where we learn to love food and love each other, and it's all about being together and cooking, and it's so joyful, which sounds great, except then the process of the show is like these families will sit down and be like, we're making this chicken curry that's been passed down from my great grandmother. It's our favorite dish and we'd have it every Sunday. And then Giorgio and Rosemary sit down and they're like, it's terrible. this curry is too dry. Who made this? And then like a 15-year-old kid is like, I made the rice. And they're like, the rice is inedible. And like, so as the show is playing out, like you can almost see the awkwardness of the sort of premise falling apart, like with each episode of the show. And occasionally, weirdly enough, I guess to counterbalance the fact that occasionally they have to tell people that their home recipes that they're so proud of are actually garbage, they also will then swing all the way to the other side. So every meal is either like, who made this lamb? The lamb is cooked perfectly. It's the literally like the Michelin starred chef will be like, this is the best sea bass I've ever tasted. And you're like, it's absolutely not. Like, stop it. But nor is it inedible garbage. If the show was honest, every time they sat down, they'd be like, it's fine. It's pretty good. I don't know. Yeah, it seems okay. And so
I'm not dead.
And then the families like face off and they have to do these things. And then at the end, like one of them get kicked off. So the whole thing is basically like, sorry, grandma and your two grandchildren. Better luck next time. So we skipped ahead and started watching season two. And it feels like they fixed a lot of the problems. Now in season two, they have four families rather than just two. It's all in one location, so it feels more like a game show rather than in the first season. There's a round of meals where they go into the homes of the people, which is always like, again, seems like it should be charming. And it's sort of nice to look and see what people's real homes and real kitchens look like. Mm-hmm. But it also exacerbates the weird awkwardness of like people literally sitting at your dining table telling you that your food isn't that great. The judges are not. Neither of them are particularly good. So they replaced both judges. The judges in the second season are the actual hosts of the show because Nadia and Zoe Ball stand around with literally nothing to do. Like they're just every episode. They're like, look at them. Wow. They're really cooking that rice. I hope the judges like it.
Yeah, it really, so, I mean, Nadia was so charming as a contestant, and this other show that she's on, I think I've talked about it on this podcast, and it was better, but like what made her charming as a contestant does not translate for me to hosting. But certainly the first season of, or like the first episode and a half that I got through of Big Family Cooking Showdown, it was like she looked terrified and it was just not a good use of her at all. And then there was this awkwardness that even in a British show where they're being perhaps a little more gentle than like Gordon Ramsay might be on Hell's Kitchen, it's like, what, like, why are we here? Are, to make tweens cry in Buckinghamshire?
Yeah,
like, I don't, why is this?
It's this weird, it's sort of betwixt and between, like, it's not like a Gordon Ramsay show where he's yelling at some failing restaurant to try to help it succeed. But there's enough kind of sourness in the sort of actual mechanics of the show that it actually feels a little bit depressing to watch. But right. That said, it's kind of interesting if you ever want to see a show sort of course correct on the fly, to compare the two seasons of the show is really interesting. And I do think, to their credit, they did manage to identify the things that didn't work in the first season and address them. Unfortunately, those things were the host, the judges, the format, and the location of the show. But the name,
it's also
persists.
No longer about food. It's painting now.
So that is also on Netflix. If you like Great British Baking Show and you're looking for British people cooking things and then having them judged, you can check it out. I don't have anything to plug, so I will just plug my employer's Britney Spears special. New York Times presents Britney Spears, Framing Britney Spears.
Excellent.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Okay, I am here today to talk about Crime Scene, : The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. Crime Scene is a four-parter on Netflix. I believe as you're listening to this, it is now out. It comes from Joe Berlinger, the... I shouldn't call him the Ryan Seacrest of prestige true crime, but here I am doing that. He's also an award winner for Brother's Keeper, the Paradise Lost trilogy. I will also stand for Cold-Blooded, the Clutter Family Murders, because I don't think enough people saw that one. If you have Sundance Now, you could stream that. It's rentable on iTunes, etc. Anyway, Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel, is the first season of what is evidently intended as an anthology series that is going to look at one Where Done It per season, trying to make Where Done It happen. The first season is about the disappearance of Elisa Lam from the Cecil in 2013, and in a broader sense about the Cecil itself. It had a bleakly storied history well before the crackpot web sleuths got to Lam's case. Spoiler of my review on Fry Timer. this particular season is fine. Berlinger is not incompetent ever, but I don't think the series quite has its feet under it yet in terms of what it's trying to be and its focus. I did say this in my review on Primetimer, but some of it does feel a bit expected in terms of the assembly. There's drone shots galore. There are reenactments that are not necessary and occasionally outright off-putting. The like you'll know the one I mean if you've watched it. As well, I think one of the crime scenes in this case or wares is the internet, but Crime Scene doesn't seem totally sure whether it thinks that's good or how to frame the involvement of like YouTubers who are in talking head interviews as experts and captioned as YouTuber, but then who also may have participated in the cyberbullying of, okay, granted a death metal performer, but he's a performer. Art, calm down. There are a lot of angles here, and I think Crime Scene can be broader in its approach to place as a factor in major cases without being as generic as it is in the first season. It's not an afternoon wasted or anything. Like I said, it's fine. But I am hoping for a bit more point of view, like a more muscular point of view from future installments. And I've listened to a couple of true crime books lately that I think might make interesting takes for future seasons, including Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s, borrowed from my wife, Tara.
Hello.
And Provenance, which is about an art forgery scam in Great Britain. Either teaming up with the authors for a Crime Scene season on like CLO Drive, or at Christie's or Sotheby's in the art world would be fantastic. There is so much potential in the Crime Scene idea, so I hope it pushes a little harder on it. And speaking of true crime books, because I have so much free time and the economy is booming right now, particularly for retail, what better time to open a true crime bookshop? But I'm doing it, bitches. If you're interested in this genre, or even in a walk down vulgar font memory lane, David T. Cole, a visit to my shop might be a great fit for you. It is not, as of this listening, formally open yet, but you can follow it on Twitter and Instagram at Exhibit B Books. In both places, EXHIBITB Books. My shop will also offer book search services, and I do wholesale purchasing. There will be frequent flash sales. Get on the mailing list at exhibitbbooks.com. Soft open in a couple of days, and I hope that you will join me. Thank you!
Coming up on the next Extra Extra Hot Grate, it is the power ranking of the cast of Freaks and Geeks, who has had the best post Freaks and Geeks time of it. We will let you know through our mathematical algorithm misers. And then on the next EHG Prime, it is Clarice with the Ringer's Allison Herman.
Indeed.
Look forward to that next week.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Canon submitter Francoise. It is called Defund the Police Shows. She writes, since this summer, I've been thinking about how cop shows do and don't contribute to an over-policed society. Do police workplace shows actually need to be about policing? Take an existing cop show, past or present, and set it in another workplace. What new jobs would the characters have? I'll go first. My show is 21 Jump Street. I was pretty confident Sarah wouldn't pick it because I think I know one of the two shows she's going to go with. 21 Jump Street was already on my mind since we watched Hull High for the Again With This Patreon recently. And there was a plot line that revolved around someone thinking one of the students was a narc. So what their new job would be, this seems obvious, but now instead of entrapping teenagers on drug busts, they are a modeling agency. Duh.
Okay.
Captain Fuller is now the head of the agency. Obviously, Hanson, Hoffs, and Aoki will have no problem getting modeling bookings.
Agree.
And if Penhall, played by Peter DeLuise, has a hard time making the transition because he doesn't have, let's say, a traditional model build, Maybe he could work security for the models when they go to their bookings, since as we learned from Models, Inc., apparently that is a situation where models are getting molested on a regular basis. Adam.
I also was going to do 21 Jump Street.
Excellent.
But mine was simply, it's the same show, except they're not cops. They're just older students who like to narc people out. I would watch that.
I would also watch that.
They're just jerks, basically.
21 Jerk Street? Sure.
Yeah, I have a similar one that has as much thought put into it, which is, it's Chips, but yes, they're Dickie D vendors now.
You should explain what Dickie D is to our non-Canadian listeners.
Oh, Dickie D is those guys that roll up on soccer games or near parks with a bike cooler full of usually branded terrible novelties, like the SpongeBob SquarePants, you know, Freezy Pop that doesn't look like SpongeBob SquarePants.
He's got one melting eye.
His eye is down by his mouth, that kind of thing. Oh, God. Yeah.
All right, Sarah, which of your two faves did you go with?
You have three guesses and the first five don't count. That's right.
There it is.
Look, there's only so much longer I can leverage this show for every single topic on here, so we're going to get through this together. Anyway, one of the things that I actually love about the show is the rapport of the cast, and more to the point, the fact that they're all, like, you know, middle-aged and old people who look their age and are appropriate ages for their jobs, which is a rarity on American TV still, especially in procedurals. So, where can you transplant this cast and still have them all believably working together? Well, I don't know how believable it is, and I fear that at least Harry Bosch is going to have to be a tenured professor of jazz, but let's post them all up at California University in the history department. They can still get embroiled in mysteries and research. They can still do the squad room shit shooting just at the faculty club.
Yep.
Ditto the drinking. They can still incorporate the political nonsense that's a part of any workplace. And one Babs Gonzalez basically already wrote the theme song. Dave, if you could please play the clip.
There's a cat in Harlem town. Got a new craze going round. Oop-a-da-bla, hit your bop. Call Professor Bop.
It is time for The Canon. Presenting this week is our guest, Adam Sternberg. Adam, take it away.
I would like to present for your consideration, for inclusion in The Canon, an episode from the HBO series Succession, also streaming now on HBO Max, season 2, episode 4, and the name of the episode is Safe Room. When I went to double check that there had not been which Succession episodes had already been inducted into the canon, I saw that there has been one from season 1, which made me happy, but I was delighted in a way to see that there hadn't been one from season 2, because this was absolutely the argument that I wanted to make. I enjoyed season 1 of Succession, but I feel like in season 2 the show hit another level, and I would put the second season of Succession up against any season of any show that I've ever seen. I think it's that good. We were talking earlier about sort of pandemic viewing projects. And one of the things I did is rewatch the entirety of Succession from the first episode through the end of season 2. And I feel like in season 2, there's any number of episodes that you could potentially put forward for the canon. Episode 3 climaxes with the kind of infamous boar on the floor game where Logan Roy humiliates his offspring and employees in one of the kind of wildest, most jaw-dropping scenes I've ever seen in a show. Episode 5 is Turnhaven, where the Roy clan goes to visit the Pierce family, who are sort of their weird bizarro world doubles, this patrician media family, and whose matriarch is Cherry Jones. Also a fantastic episode. And of course, episode 12, the finale of the season, This Is Not for Tears, which is sort of this, the entire Roy family is herded onto this super yacht to await the news of which of them will be sacrificed by Logan Roy for the sins of the company. It kind of plays out like an Agatha Christie locked room mystery, except you're waiting to find out not who the murderer is, but who the victim will be. all of which I think are actually fantastic episodes of television. But the reason I chose episode 4, Safe Room, is because it sort of encapsulates everything that Succession does so well. The sort of tonal agility of the episode and also the thematic elegance of it. I feel like it's perfectly constructed, and it ends with perhaps my favorite closing image in any TV show ever, which obviously we will get to. So to Succession, like many people, I came to the show somewhat late and a little warily. I remember when the first season premiered, it seemed to have that typical HBO gloss. It had an impressive cast and the Veep pedigree of Jeremy Armstrong, the creator. And it also had this great high concept premise, which was like, it's King Lear, but it's the Murdochs. But at the same time, you know, in 2018, did I really want to sit down every week and spend time with this family of venal rich assholes when I felt like I was spending so much of my time normally having to worry about the antics of various families of venal rich assholes, whether it was in the news or elsewhere? I also found it a little hard to get into the show, as I think some people do when they first start watching the first season, because there's questions of tone. Is it a comedy? Is it a satire? Is it a sort of serious Shakespearean drama of court intrigue and succession battles? And when I finished the first season, I thought, yeah, that was a very entertaining, well-wrought season of television. I didn't even start watching season 2 when it first premiered. I figured I'd get around to it. And then when I started watching it each week, it just got better and better and better. And to me, the run of the 3 episodes, the Hunting, which is the Boar on the Floor episode, Safe Room and Turn Haven, are as good as 3 consecutive episodes of television that I've ever seen. So In Safe Room, we start out with the Roy family. We're about a third of the way into season 2. Kendall Roy, the eldest son, is essentially a hollowed out character at that point. His efforts in season 1 to commit a sort of patricide against his father have been malevolently thwarted. He's completely defeated, and he's now spent the first few episodes of the season carrying out his father's kind of directives, like this kind of broken Darth Vader to Emperor Palpatine. And in this episode, we begin with Kendall marching up the stairs at the ATN headquarters skyscraper in the middle of New York. He's marching up the stairs to the roof. He walks out to this sort of panoramic view of the city. And you get a sense that this is like a fairly straightforward visual metaphor about what the show is all about, which is like ascension, trying to climb the rungs of the company. And then he's out on the roof in this sort of master of all he surveys moment. He then places a phone call to Rhea Jarrell, who's the CEO of the Pierce Empire, media empire, which his father Logan has decided that they need to take over for their company to survive. Safe Room is a little bit different from typical episodes in season 2, because I think a thing that the writers figured out in the second season was a kind of winning formula. The Succession writers' room is sort of disproportionately populated with playwrights, and Jeremy Armstrong himself comes from a playwriting background, and a lot of them are English playwrights. I think the writers' room for Succession is in London. And what a lot of the really successful episodes do is they just take all the characters, put them in one place and kind of let the sparks fly. That's what happens in The Boar on the Floor. That's what happens in Turn Haven. There's a sort of Davos inspired conference that they all go to in a later episode. And those episodes all work really well. Safe Room is a little bit more traditional in its structure, in that each of the children has their own plot line and they all sort of play out concurrently. So Kendall is helping his father, Logan, engineer the takeover of Pierce. Roman, the youngest son, played by Kieran Culkin, is sort of exiled off to management training at an amusement park so he can prove his managerial bona fides to his father. Shiv Roy, the daughter, has been secretly anointed as the heir to her father, and she's shadowing him at the company and sort of gradually figuring out that her father, as he does to everyone, is actually screwing her over. And Connor, the hapless eldest son, has been dispatched to this funeral for this underloved colleague they had named Mo, where he's going to deliver the eulogy. The other character who plays prominently in this episode is my personal favorite character on the show and on television, Tom Wamsbaugh, played by Matthew McFadyen. Rewatching the whole series, it becomes pretty clear that Tom was originally included, I think, potentially to be comic relief. He's sort of a jester and he's a bit of a buffoon. And the way in which his character evolves over the two seasons and becomes a much more nuanced portrayal of a person who's both venal and amoral, but also troubled by the amorality he sees around him, improbably Tom becomes sort of the moral center of the show. And in this episode, we see this play out in a way that's actually laugh out loud funny, because he has been placed at the head of ATN, the Fox-like network that the Roys control. And one of his first tasks is evaluating the extent to which they may or may not have to jettison this star, this rising star anchor, who could possibly probably be a Nazi. So his initial conversations sort of lay bare the way that all the moral considerations happen in the Succession universe. Every ethical consideration is only a cold, pragmatic calculation about how will this further the interests both of the family, the company, and of course, each of the individual characters. And so Tom has been dispatched to figure out whether they have to get rid of this anchor named Mark Ravenhead. And in the first clip, Cousin Greg, who has become Tom's right-hand man, is reporting back to him some of the less than encouraging news that he's dug up on their star anchor. So that's clip number one.
So, Herr Ravenhead, do you have anything for me ahead of my meet?
Honestly, I've been asking around and not much. I heard he named his dog after Hitler's dog, maybe? Blondie?
That's not good. But, you know, Logan likes and America likes, and Blondie is pretty common.
No, but I mean, fascist meeting, Nazi wedding, Hitler dog.
Oh, dude, if it's true, he's gone. I mean, Nazis, terrible, right?
Nazis?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're the worst.
Yeah, sure. We all hate Nazis. And we all hate Sid. Right, Jonah?
I should have mentioned in setting up the clip that this entire conversation happens while both characters have their feet propped up on a co-worker named Jonah, who's lost a bet, and so he's having to serve as their footstool while they're having this conversation. I just love that line reading of Nazis, they're so bad, right? Like the way that no one in the show can ever just be morally steadfast. Tom is constantly taking the temperature of the people around him and trying to figure out where they stand and then where he should recalibrate his own position in relationship to them. This is one of those episodes where I felt like I could have pulled, you know, taken the hour and split it into 120 30-second clips, and each of them would have been enjoyable on its own. But I decided to focus on this through line of Ravenhead because I think it's so sort of masterfully played out. It demonstrates the sort of tonal agility of the show and how which I think really it found its feet in the second season, that it manages to be very funny about subjects that are actually quite dark and topical. For example, this ATN Fox-like network that is sort of poisoning the well of the American media. So in the second clip, this is now Tom confronting Mark Ravenhead, and you can tell as he dissembles and sort of tries to smooth the whole thing over, he's simultaneously awakening to the sort of severity of the situation and how terrible this anchor really is, and realizing that he's the one who's going to have to clean up the mess. And that's clip two.
Okay, so this is embarrassing, but just for the record and just so we have it, you are not and have never been a member of the Nazi Party of the United States, have you? Come on, Tom, are you serious? Nope. Thank you. Sorry to have to even ask. And oh yes, the Hitler dog thing. Okay, the dog thing is bullshit. Great, great. I thought so. Different spelling. Okay, different spelling.
Yeah.
Okay. And this other one that came up, just to fend this off. Have you ever read Mein Kampf?
Yeah, a couple times, I guess.
Couple times. Are there Easter eggs in there you didn't get the first time?
Look, I'm interested in that period of history, Tom, okay? I skimmed it.
Skimmed, yeah, thank you. And what specifically do you find interesting about that period of history?
The scale, the tragedy.
Hell yeah. Yeah, and which tragedies specifically?
Europe decimated. 7 million Germans, 20 million Russians, 5 million Poles.
Yeah. Just checking the till here, Mark, and it seems you're short a few million.
So that exchange, as you heard, is cut off by the sound of a gunshot. There's been a shooting in the ATN headquarters, and this is where the episode pivots. Because of the gunshot, ATN goes into lockdown. Tom and Greg are shuffled off to a sort of storeroom that serves as a temporary panic room with a security guard. Meanwhile, Logan and Shiv and Rhea Jarrell, the CEO that they've been negotiating with, are sent to a much nicer executive panic room. And there's a fantastic exchange, which I didn't clip, but where Tom finds out that there's another different panic room and he starts to freak out because he wasn't invited to the VIP panic room. At one point, he's like, I'm in the wrong panic room. Meanwhile, ATN has like on the fly turned this into this sort of ATN under siege news moment. There's talk of Antifa and protesters have somehow breached the building, and they've instantaneously created this whole narrative in a very Fox News kind of way. In the meantime, the other characters are off doing their thing. Roman is at his training. Connor has gone off to the funeral. And this third clip I chose because it's, again, a perfect example of the kind of like dark, dark, dark humor that Succession so expertly pulls off. Connor and his girlfriend are at the funeral of this colleague named Mo, and his girlfriend has expressed her condolences to the widow and about her husband Mo, and the widow doesn't know who she's talking about. So Connor has to explain to her that Mo was not his real name, it was a nickname. And that's this next clip.
His name's not Mo.
What do you call him Mo?
His name's Lester.
Wait, so why does everyone call him
his
Mo?
His real name is Lester. It was... I guess I haven't thought about it for a while, but it was kind of a joke.
Like, what?
Mo Lester? I guess it wasn't a very nice joke.
And was he one?
Oh, God, no. Just, you know, old Mr. Fiddlesticks, Uncle Meathands.
Right.
Dad wouldn't let us in the pool with him. But, you know, the guys of that generation, it was a different time. Okay. Just get a donor on the end of this boner. I feel a pack attack coming on.
The way in which that exchange is crafted is just so masterful. The kind of realization that the joke maybe actually isn't in good taste. The idea of like, oh, he's not so bad. You know, old Uncle Meathands. And then the line reading where he's like, oh, you know, guys of that generation were just different, manages to actually capture and perfectly encapsulate like an attitude of every Me Too apologist. And this is like the, not even the A or B storyline for the episode. This is like the D storyline. So back to the A storyline, people are secured in their panic room. Meanwhile, Kendall has wandered back up to the roof again, and this time he has stepped out onto the ledge. And we start to see that Kendall's visit to the roof at the beginning of the episode takes on a more malevolent tone, that he is dreaming not of conquering the world and being the master of all he surveys, but finding a way to escape this world that he is now trapped in, as kind of made emblematic by the ATN headquarters. Logan is frantically trying to locate him. Meanwhile, Tom and Greg are stuck in their little second tier panic room. And Greg decides, having seen this whole thing play out with the Nazi anchor, that he just can't take it anymore. And he of all the characters is going to try to take a moral stand simply by stepping away. He doesn't want to work with Tom anymore. He tries to explain to Tom that he needs to take a break. Tom does not take it well. And there's a moment where Greg says to him that maybe they could just have like an open business relationship, which unbeknownst to him, brings out in Tom all of this resentment that he has, which he's never expressed, about the fact that his wife essentially forced an open marriage on him when they got married at the end of season one. And Tom explodes in a very Tom Wamsbaugh kind of way, which is clip number four.
Hey, Tom, we're good. We're good.
We're good? We're good? Because it doesn't feel fucking good, Greg!
Let's just, can we...
I will not let you do this to me! I will not let go of what is mine!
What am I doing? Ow! Stop pumping! No! Stop!
Fuck!
Stop!
Fuck!
Stop! Security!
Guys! No, you back off! You back off! This is executive level business! Okay? No!
Stop, Tom! We're friends! You're one of my best friends!
This meltdown by Tom is such a beautifully calibrated scene. And the fact that we as the viewers know the backstory and know that what he's in fact reacting to is something that Greg couldn't possibly know about and is all this pent up anger and resentment he has about his relationship with his wife and his position in the family and the way in which he has been sort of continually ridiculed. Matthew McFadden plays it perfectly. And the thing that really impressed me about this. So he starts throwing water bottles, like full bottles of plastic bottles of water at Greg. And when you think about the different things that he could be throwing at him, a lot of things would be too serious. Like if he started throwing staplers or office equipment at him, the scene would suddenly become too menacing. But if he's throwing like balled up pieces of paper at him, then it's too comic. And I feel like in a weird way, the bottled water is like the perfect representation of the show's tonal balancing act, because bottled water would actually hurt you if someone was throwing it at you. And yet the scene itself is also funny. And of course you get the added metaphorical resonance of Tom being this bottled up character. That scene resolves when they figure out that the shooter at ATN was not in fact an Antifa invader or some sort of left-wing radical enemy, but was one of the news producers committing suicide because he was in the midst of a moral crisis over his work at ATN, which of course rolls very neatly off the backs of Logan and the other people. And in fact, ironically, in the way that these things happen on Succession, the fact that Logan was locked down with Rhea allows him to pin her down and enlist her in his quest to take over Pierce. So it actually works out great for Logan, the fact that one of his all the way down ladder employees committed suicide because he could no longer face himself. He also is asking about Kendall, and they say that they had found Kendall up on the roof. And the security guard sort of during the exchange is implying that like Kendall, when he found him, was sort of threatening self-harm. So you have this parallel of the employee committing suicide and Kendall considering his own suicide. And the final shot, as all these storylines wrap up, the final shot echoes the opening of the episode, where Kendall goes back up to the roof and finds that someone, it's not made explicit who it is, but it's fairly obvious, has erected this glass barrier on the roof. So it's no longer possible for someone to, say, for example, throw themselves off the top of the building. And Kendall leans his head against the glass. We see him twinned with his reflection in the glass. And we realize that the theme of the whole episode, which is called Safe Room, is not about being a world conqueror, but this sort of prison that these characters have erected around themselves, that these forces, which in this case is Kendall's father, you know, keeping him both safe from the consequences of his own actions, the consequences of the company's actions, consequences which its other employees have been, you know, borne on themselves in graphic ways in the episode. Kendall is both kept safe from the outside world, but also prevented from escaping this world. This is the irony of the safe room. I've watched this episode a few times now. I think it's just perfect from beginning to end. It exemplifies all the things that Succession does in ways that always knock me out. And so that is why I am submitting it to you for inclusion in the canon.
Dave, why don't you start us off? I'll go last.
Oh, okay. So we'll start with Dave's stupid little comments before we get into the serious liberal arts study majors take on things. Very good. You didn't get into the Roman storyline, but that was delicious in its own way.
So funny.
Starting with him eating, not eating a theme park Danish. This was, just a perfect little note. The one thing I actually do want to talk about is the panic rooms. So we have the grunt level panic room on the working floor of the network. And then we have the executive panic room where Logan is. In the sort of storeroom panic room. We have 100 calorie Hanover pretzel packets, similar small bags of Cheez-Its, those little mini waters that were being thrown around, and Quaker Rice Krisps.
Ugh.
Now, up in the executive one, and I had to pause it and kind of like figure out, it was out of focus, but this is what I could figure out. Voss water.
Of course.
Sun chips. Salt and vinegar, Miss Vicky's kettle chips. Oh,
Dave Nip.
Big things of mixed nuts, not just little packs, but you know, the big containers you can stick your hand in and grab a whole bunch.
Yeah.
They had beef jerky. And they had a whole bunch of different granola bars and things like that. And I think maybe something like root vegetable chips, I think I saw in there too.
There's also bunk beds, by the way.
Never mind that, you know, one is obviously
full bar as well.
Yeah.
A storeroom, and Tom is like, somebody could just crawl through that window up there, right? Like a little child.
An attack child.
So good.
So I enjoyed the snack disparity.
Yes.
There. The eulogy, which was not clipped, but
oh my God,
is an amazing piece of nothing, because Connor has political ambitions at this point. His eulogy is recrafted into like a nothing. Like, it is the beige neutral 50-50 of speeches.
Name, rank, and serial number.
This was a man
number.
Who died. His wife is sad. We are all sad. He once was here, but now he's gone. Like, this is the speech over a minute. It is absolutely fantastic.
So good. And then the first version, Lester touched all of us like, he's so proud of it, too.
I want to hear from Tara, all the smart. Oh, I want to hear from Sarah, one of the smarty pants.
Oh, you'll regret that. This show is on the mythical list.
The scroll.
Yes, the scroll. The doom scroll. And I had this impression the last time we spoke about a Succession episode for the canon, which is how impressive it is that this combination of writing and the performing of this writing still allows you to feel maybe not like pity exactly, but like that you feel sorrow for these people, even though they're complete shit fucks. Like Kendall, whatever, but what was, what did he like Chappaquiddick somebody in the last episode we talked about. Right. So,
yes.
And yet you feel, and I had no context for him before that. Basically, like I understood the premise of the show, but I was meeting him for the first time. And in this episode, like at the end, when he's sort of like, he comes up on the barrier and is like, and, that as much work as that shot does with, sort of impressions and perspectives on perspectives and stuff like that. Like you really feel sort of this deep compassion for this guy who would like step over you to pick up a nickel on the other side of you. Like I don't know quite how that alchemy works, but like Shiv is another example. Like you sort of feel, there is a relatable sense in which these characters can literally never relax at any time because they're just beset on all sides. And like, there is no safe room anywhere for any of them. To an extent, there's like a Roman in the turkey costume, but like, whatever. I don't get the impression Roman ever really feels unsafe. He's just like doing his, like putting a rug in his mouth, being like, nope, and putting it back on the plate. Like that does so much. Like the economy of showing what Daisy Buchanan's these characters are is so amazing. And I think that this episode is an excellent example of that. And it's like the Thomist Tom, like just even the way he's throwing the water bottles where he thinks he's like whipping it really wickedly sidearm and they're still missing a guy who's 6 feet from him and extremely tall. Like how? But that's perfect. That's very Tom. And oh my God, that eulogy. Like, and just watching the fact that Connor doesn't even quite totally realize what he's saying, like, and how devoid of content it is. And then there's like the, you know, you end on this like phone sex thing with Roman. I mean, it is like corrosively horrible commentary on the Murdochs and the Kennedys and like American corporate royalty. But there is this genuine sadness to the people also that you can hold on to because they are all terrible, but they're also like, especially the kids are just like, they never had a chance to suck.
Yeah, it makes them tragic.
Yeah, really. I mean, it's like everything around them is tragic. And there's this moment like Shiv, this character, like master's theses will be written about her and probably have been already. But when they're commenting on this, on the what the situation with the shooter turned out to be, and she says, like, a lot of introspection ahead, but, like, just not even, like, she's looking at her phone and, like, looking at the snacks and, like, not even paying attention, just autopilot. Like, yeah, a lot of introspection ahead. Like, it's just so perfectly done and, like, a pH of one. The whole thing. It's really good. It's not cheery stuff, but yeah, this is a great episode, and like all great canon entries, it made me want to keep watching. So Tara, you're the expert here. Take us
all on. Right. Two factual corrections just so you don't get tweets, Adam. It's Jesse Armstrong, not Jeremy. It's confusing because there's Jeremy Strong in the cast, which is very careless of them to be
My apologies to Jesse Armstrong.
Similarly named. And also it's Tom Wamsgams, the horrible Wamsba would be a better name, but they had to give him so many consonants in that stupid, dumb name. I also made Dave watch Succession in early pandemic. I had pitched it a number of times, and it was not until we, like...
The story being, like Adam was saying, I had a really tough time getting into it on first watch, and I did not like the pilot that much.
Yeah.
And I just kind of was like, eh, there's lots of other stuff to watch. But then, of course, you know, 2020 rolled around, and we were all staring at the walls. So, yeah, Tara made me watch it as she was rewatching it for...
A book?!
The Get sweet out. Smell of Succession, her podcast with Jay Chen.
Yes.
And yeah, I really got into it.
Yeah. And I pitched it to Dave, I think the tone that you have to come into it with, as Adam sort of got hinted at or said too, is like, if you have to approach it as a dark, dark comedy in the trappings of an HBO prestige drama.
Yeah.
Because it certainly has dramatic elements too. I mean, the tragedy of Kendall, certainly, but like...
Yeah, it's British comedy meets HBO meets Shakespeare.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the hour-long runtime confuses you as well, but I think it is like a pitch-dark comedy. So that should inform you if you still haven't gotten on board. Adam, excellent argument. The few things that I think that I would have mentioned that you didn't was like just the gamesmanship of the Rhea meeting is masterful to watch. Her stonewalling them and then being forced to come back because of the situation at ATN, and then the negotiation that ironically happens in the panic room. When she's just being very quiet and telling them like, you're negotiating against yourself. And then it just keeps going because she's that good and they're that desperate. And both of them know what their parts are and like what they have to say and what they can't say. I mean, the way that scene plays out is so good, even with Shiv in the middle of it, like not really knowing what had happened before and like not doing her best to fuck it up, but like almost fucking it up and putting Rhea accidentally in the position of like, arguing the pro-merger case because of Shiv arguing against it is very interesting writing. To surface Tom as the lead, like, yeah, the his whole arc through this episode, starting from using Jonah as a footstool to shoving his underlings out of the way as he runs to the shitty panic room. Stampeding to then he ends up there and realizes that's where he is when he's on the phone with Shiv and her like not giving a shit because she knows she's in the good panic room. And like it's like before we even get to Greg accidentally bringing up the whole thing of like the open marriage that he is unhappily in. Everything that Shiv ever does in their marriage is to make him feel insecure. And Tom like arrived. It's established in the first season that he arrived in New York like from a well-off Minnesota family. His parents are both lawyers, but then he met Shiv and was like in a whole other level of wealth that he like could not even fathom. And he still can't. And like, he's trying to get to the level of like, we certainly see it in the yacht episode where he's trying to act like he belongs there, but he knows in his soul that he doesn't. And this situation where he's like, oh no, I'm in the wrong panic room. It's like, once again, I am insecure in this relationship. I am the supplicant, and Shiv is not doing anything to make me feel any better. Not that she can. It's not like she can tell him where she is, but still, it's like, already he is on the back foot, and then Greg is like, it's like we're in an open business relationship. It's like, oh, no, that's the even worse thing to say. And the other thing about throwing the projectiles, the water bottles, is that when the situation is over and they all leave the room, it's like, I just thought it was such a funny detail. Like, they're still on the floor. No one picked them up. Because of course they didn't. Like, even the lower level people that are also trapped in there with them and don't get any lines, like, even they didn't pick them up either. But finally, I think the most emblematic Succession thing about this episode, other than Shiv pretending to give a shit, and Rhea too, for that matter, about the shooting, is that we never find out who the shooter was. Like, yeah. I feel like we're supposed to think it might be Jonah, the footstool. But,
right.
But we never know because it doesn't matter.
Right.
Like, the only reason that this plot device happens is for the purpose of the show, how it affects the Roys. Like, he's a faceless nobody. It does not matter who he is.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, this is why we never get an episode where we follow one of the lower level people home. Doesn't matter. Like, they don't exist. They don't exist in Succession world. And I just think that's such a smart choice.
I thought the other kind of part and parcel with that was like Greg's last salvo, which is to bring up the blackmail item he has again. And that's the only way, even though he's technically family of some sort.
Right.
He's never going to assent by merit. Not that he's very good at his job, but he's learning that this is the way this world operates. And in a weird way, Tom is proud of him for it because he's figured out the game.
Yes. And I should say, that's a point that Dave Chan always made on Sweet Smell of Succession, which is like, this is the only thing anyone that Roy adjacent ever respects, which is scumbagging someone, which is why Tom is so delighted when he's like, are you trying to blackmail me? He's like, he loves it.
I accept your blackmail.
Exactly.
So good.
So yeah, that's another great detail. And like, and finally, the thing with Kendall realizing that they put up the glass, like that as the coda to the scene of Jerry telling Shiv, he's in a bad way, he's shoplifting, and they know. And Shiv is like, okay, well, what are we doing about it? And Jerry's like, well, we're just keeping an eye on it. Like, no one is talking to Kendall about it, and no one's talking to Kendall about this either. It's like, God, again, none of these children has a fucking chance, even the ones who think they're doing great, like Shiv. So
ducks and beach balls, every one of them.
Amazing episode, great presentation. Thank you, Adam, for bringing it back to us.
Thank you. I should just add two things. First of all, my sincere apologies to Jesse Armstrong and also Tom Wambsgan, my favorite character, who I then called by the wrong name. Although, if you think about it on a meta level, it's a very Tom Wambsganian thing to have happen.
Absolutely.
I was just going to say,
someone's praising you, they are getting your name wrong. And this is a little bit adjacent to like the argument for this particular episode, but you know, Sarah, you were talking about the kind of improbable sympathy that you feel for these characters. And one of the things that amazed me about season two, as it built up to the very tense finale, this idea of the blood sacrifice and how one of the characters has to be sacrificed, it was one of the tensest cliffhangers that I could remember on a TV show. Like, people were talking about it on social media, and it was all the speculation, who's it going to be? And then you're sort of watching the episode like it's all going to be revealed. It reminded me, the last time I felt that way was watching the end of Breaking Bad, when you were like, how is this all going to resolve? But I was like, this show manages to do this not only with no guns or, you know, no one's going to be killed. Like, there's these weird stakes that exist, even though none of it actually matters. The worst that's going to happen to any of these people is that they're still rich and they just didn't get a job they wanted. Yeah. Like, that's literally what the stakes of the show are. But it somehow turns it into this Shakespearean drama where you're so invested in like how it's all going to play out. I think it's just so, so masterfully done. I'm so impressed by the work of Mr. Jesse Armstrong and his
it's an amazing
cadre
show.
of UK and some American playwrights who put it all together.
All right, let's put this to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
Congratulations, Neil Armstrong, a hero in all endeavors. Just kidding. It is a yes for me.
It's a yes for me. I would like to thank my second grade teacher, Mrs. Armstrong.
I'm going to give this to Jeremy Davies. Congratulations.
No, all Louis right, Armstrong. That's come on, man.
A sweep. So. That means Succession, Season 2, Episode 4, Safe Room. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
I'm sorry, it's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Who has our winner?
Sarah D. Bunting.
I do. I feel like this show is like the Hootie and the Blowfish of TV. Like, it's everywhere. It's on all the time, but no one actually owns the CD or watches the show. It's Impractical Jokers, renewed for season 10, I know, at True TV. And the stars have also struck a first look deal with HBO Max. I am sad that our guest from 2 weeks ago, Dan Rogge, is not here to hear this victory, because he and I were in a comedy class in 1997 with Impractical Joker Sal Vulcano. I really did not think it was going to go that way for him. He was funny, but he was also shy. And now he's rich. Excellent work, young man. Pride of Staten Island. Keep it up.
And loser of the week?
Well, I mean, relatively, but it's NBC's Legacy, once again, going for an all-drama lineup on Thursdays for the first time since 2015. Used to be NBC was the place you went for a rock block of all the sitcoms you most wanted to watch on Thursdays, whether it started with The Cosby Show, whether it was Seinfeld at 9 p.m. or Cheers at 9, or The Office somewhere in there.
Or Men Behaving Badly.
Of course, or Boston Common. So many wonderful hits. But
Batman of the People.
Oh.
Yes, Fired Up, starring Sharon Lawrence. I could go
and
on.
The rest.
Indeed. But for the first time since 2015, when The Slap was on, remember The Slap?
The Slap.
I do. there's going to be an all-drama lineup on Thursdays. Sigh. It's going to be Manifest, a show that is somehow still on.
Wow.
I know. Followed by Sarah D. Bunting's favorite show, Law & Order, Special Victims Unit. Followed by what is probably going to be your second favorite show, Law & Order, Organized Crime.
If they ever finish making it.
I know. They had a positive COVID test they had to shut down this week.
Oh,
but
they sound a little disorganized.
Probably from filming in beautiful Bay Ridge.
But, yeah.
Word, but.
So, that's our loser. Poor NBC. And its comedies.
Speaking about being disorganized, you know what time it is? Yeah, game time. All right, everybody, welcome back to Game Time. This is the eighth Game Time of the season. The scores currently are Tara with 3, Sarah with 2, Value Guess with 2. Today we are playing Hail to the Chiefs from Corey.
Hi, you've reached the Corey hotline. $4.95 a minute. Here are some words that rhyme with Corey. Glory, story, allegory, Montessori.
Yes, that's Corey, not a boy AH, who earns herself an extra credit topic, ka-ching, for this effort. This game was fleshed out with the help of our helper elves at EHG Assist. Thank you very much, guys, for filling out this game. In this game, you will hear a blended description of an American president and a TV character who share the same last name. You name the TV character.
Okay.
If you need a hint, I will tell you who played the character in question. So, without the hint, 2 points. After the hint, 1 point.
Got it.
That's how we do it. Let's throw it to Pinky to see who will be going first.
We will start with valued guest.
Oh, that means Adam is starting first. Then Sarah, then Tara. Are we ready to play Hail to the Chiefs?
Yes, sir.
Hail, yes, sir. Yeah.
All right. So remember, the answer is going to be the TV character.
Steel Mule?
Let's interrupt this for the Steel Mule report.
Thank you, Dave.
Exciting.
Here is our steel meal situation. Sarah DeBunting has 7 steel meals.
Wow.
I have 9 steel meals.
Wow.
Adam, I'm sorry to tell you, the valued guests have been cleaned out.
I'm going to have to talk to the valued guests after this. The valued guest union.
All right, here we go. Adam's first blended description is, this president moved on up from Monticello to a deluxe apartment in the sky.
This is literally the first one I thought of when you described the the premise of the game. George Jefferson.
That is correct. 2 points. Sarah D. Bunting. Clear eyes, full heart, can't lose the election of 1848.
The election of 1848. Oh, she says, stalling because she can't remember the last name.
What's his wife's name? It's alliterative.
Clear eyes, full heart, can't lose the election of 1848.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the thing is that I know it's Friday Night Lights, but my mind has emptied of president names, so in an effort to stall, I'd like a hint, please.
Your hint is Kyle Chandler.
No, of course that didn't help. Ellen Sepinwall is going to drive over here and shoot me. I don't know. Buzz me.
That answer is Coach Taylor.
Zachary Taylor.
That right. Mofo.
Tara.
Yes.
A nuclear engineer in the Navy and former peanut farmer, this doctor saw some crazy stuff, but nothing worse than what he saw under the bed.
Oh, I thought I had it, but then I didn't. Hint.
Noah Wiley.
Okay, Dr. Oh my God, what was his first name? Carter?
That's fine.
Okay.
For a lot of these, I'll agree. Okay. I would have accepted Coach Taylor. I'll accept Dr. Carter. Dr. John Carter.
John! Was what the most generic name. I was thinking it was Agent Carter.
Good he also went to Mars.
Back to Adam. This founding father and first vice president accomplished a lot before he escaped into the woods to live alone with his bear.
Grizzly Adams.
Grizzly Adams, 2 points.
Nice.
Correct. Sarah DeBunting. This long-serving police lieutenant spoke Dutch at home, becoming the first and, so far, only ESL president.
Anita Van Buren.
Correct for 2. Nice. Tara.
Yes.
The classic rich California blonde was the perfect choice to lead the nation during the gold rush and when California joined the Union.
Hint.
Jenny Garth.
Kelly Taylor?
Correct.
Okay.
Adam. This former track star went to prison for possessing a small amount of weed, not for chopping down a cherry tree.
This former track star went to prison for possessing weed. It's somebody Washington. I have no idea what TV show it is, though. But can I get the hint?
Samara Wiley.
I guess I can't call her track star Washington.
Good try, though.
The show
Steel Mill! Steel Mill!
Okay.
Poussey Washington.
Correct. From Orange is the New Black.
Oh, yes.
Sarah D. Bunting. The first vice president to become president through succession, this leader was also an excellent traveling companion.
He's also an excellent traveling companion. Hint?
Billy Piper.
He's president through succession. Don't know.
I only know her first name.
Which is?
Rose.
Rose Tyler.
Ah.
Oh.
Tara.
Yeah.
A wisecracking field doctor, this alcoholic president was described as the hero of many a well-fought battle.
I hope it's Hawkeye Pierce.
Hawkeye Pierce from MASH is correct.
Don't know anything about that president.
Adam, despite the creepy habit of peering over the fence at the neighbors, this president led the country through World War I, but retained his creep factor through support of racial segregation.
Oh, gosh, what was that? God, neighbor Wilson. Wilson? Wasn't he just called Wilson the neighbor on that show, The Creepy Neighbor? Yeah, creepy Wilson?
Yeah. Wilson. From Home Improvement. Sarah D. Bunting. Yeah. This patriarch of his Landview, Pennsylvania family was the only native-born Pennsylvanian to be elected president until Joe Biden.
Oh my God, how fucking sad that I knew this before you finished reading the clue, Asa Buchanan.
Wow, I didn't think anybody was going to get that one, but she got
no
it for two.
ABC Soap family.
Bringing us halfway into the game and our first and only score break for Tara.
Yep.
This teenage sketch comic also signed the Missouri Compromise to protect the admission of slave-owning states into the Union, but also stood against colonization by Europeans. That's so random.
Oh, no. Hint?
Demi Lovato.
I mean, of course, we all remember President iCarly. No, that wasn't her. That was the other one. I don't remember what show she was on. I don't know.
That's awesome.
Anyone? Steel Meal?
That is Sunny Monroe. All right, that'll take us into the score break. Halfway, let's hear the scores, please.
Oh my God, it's such a close game. Adam has 6 points, I have 5 points, Sarah has 4 points.
All right, Sarah, guess what? You are in the Queen Latifah Equalizer Yay! Challenge Zone.
Updated for 2021.
My favorite Equalizer Challenge Zone.
Just for this one. Just because this is what I have on hand, you get this and you have no choice. You've got six TV questions from the 1990s. Special edition Trivial Pursuit box.
Come on.
Okay.
All right. So each one is from a particular year. I will also read you the year.
Hey.
In fact, why don't I put them in chronological order? What sitcom character snapped back at Dan Quayle? I'm glamorizing single motherhood. What planet is he on?
Murphy Brown.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was 1992. I already forgot my promise. What cable hit was all about what happens when people stop being polite and start getting real? 1994.
The Real World.
Two for two. What former Cheers character could be reached at 555 KACL in Seattle?
Frasier Crane. And you should know.
That's three for three. I got to pull out some more cards.
How many is that worth? That's worth four?
What gangly TV star recorded the novelty song, I think I can beat Mike Tyson, before appearing on the silver screen as Muhammad Ali?
Will Smith.
Here we go. What Saved by the Bell star served as a tag team partner of a pro wrestler dubbed the Blue Meanie?
What Saved by the Bell character or
star.
Actor?
Star.
Star. Dustin Diamond.
Dustin Diamond. Correct.
Oh! R.I.P.
Five for five. You could really vault
out ahead.
We haven't had a double up in a while.
It's true.
What did Kendra call the lucky steak she gave to Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Mr. Pointy.
Six for six.
Whoa.
That means she's got 8 points. Whoa. A double sweep point situation. So the score is
updated.
Damn. Sarah D. Bunting has 5 million.
Well, I still have 5. Adam still has 6. Sarah now has 12 points.
12 points. All right, here we go. Let's get back into it. That was probably too many points for that, but whatever. Well. Let's just do it. Adam, after gaining fame as a flamed-haired movie starlet and army general, this president created Yellowstone National Park.
Flame-haired... Wait. It's like Lucille Ball. We did not have a president named Ricardo. I'll take the hint, please.
Your hint, the actor involved is Tina Louise.
Oh. Ginger. Oh, Yellowstone, but gosh, what was her last name? Ginger Lee?
Ginger Grant. Ginger Grant.
I was like, Ginger Roosevelt?
That's what I was thinking too.
Whoops.
This This lonely Republican staffer with a notorious sweet tooth won election by only a single Electoral College vote.
Lonely with a notorious sweet tooth. Hint, please.
Emily Proctor.
Oh.
Talk it out.
Gilbert Ann Sullivan?
Ainsley Hayes.
Oh.
Back to Tara.
Yeah.
An animated yet depressed second grade teacher who was president during the Great Depression.
Miss Edna Hoover. Oh, her name isn't Hoover. Or, I mean, it's Miss Hoover, yeah. Not Edna.
It's Miss Elizabeth Hoover. Edna Crabapple.
We maybe never know her first name. Whoops.
All right, this is for Adam. Mostly uptight, but prone to explosive outbursts at his deserving friends, this lawyer was the first president to use nuclear weapons.
Well, his last name is Truman. Who is the uptight, explosive, rage-filled lawyer who exploded at his friends? I don't want to say Will, but I'm going to take the hint.
Eric McCormick.
Oh, Will Truman. There you go.
There you go. Sarah D. Bunting. This president couldn't have the quiet retirement at the family farm that he probably wanted, so he ended up producing reality TV, including his own show called Passport to Dance.
Hint.
Jeffrey Boyer Chapman.
I got nothing.
He's a toughie. Anybody?
The show guy from Unreal.
It's Jay Carter from Unreal.
Right.
Oh, right.
Back to Tara.
Yep.
A football star born Leslie Lynch King Jr., this president was marooned on a strange island and then traveled back in time or something?
Oh, my God. There's so many of them. Hint.
Josh Holloway.
Sawyer.
Yeah, but I need the character. I need the actual name. Unless you think Sawyer is a president.
I don't know his last name. Shit. Anyone? I don't know his real name.
Are Lost fans called Losties? What are
probably.
They? Maybe a Lostie, but no, this one. James Sawyer Ford.
I didn't remember that at all.
All right, back to Adam.
Don't know too many presidents.
What you talking about, Willis? The Trail of Tears?
Oh, wow.
What was it? It's Gary Coleman, Willis, and what was his name on Different Strokes? Jackson is his last name. Willis and Gary Coleman played Little Scooby Jackson.
Anybody else want to give that answer?
It's Arnold, right?
Arnold, yeah.
Arnold.
All right, back to Sarah. We wonder if this fourth president annoyed the neater residents of the White House by being such a slob.
Oscar Madison?
Nice.
Correct. 2 points. Tara.
Yep.
In addition to being an anesthesiologist and mother of five, she is somehow both the 17th and the 36th president.
Rainbow Johnson.
Correct. And we're back to Adam. Is everybody's last question?
Okay.
After solidly losing the New Hampshire primary, this president dropped his reelection bid and decided his time would be better spent as a small town sheriff. And I will say, the answer to this one is the most direct of all the answers.
Okay.
Sorry, can you read the question again?
After solidly losing the New Hampshire primary, this president dropped his reelection bid and decided his time would be better spent as a small town sheriff.
There's no president named Roscoe P. Coltrane. I believe the president in question is Lyndon Johnson. So the small town sheriff... I'm going to say Sheriff Johnson.
Wrong president. Anybody?
Is it Harry Truman? Truman from
Harry
Twin
S.
Peaks?
Truman from Twin Peaks. Yeah.
Ah, another Truman.
All right. For Sarah, this character had an explosive end set in the home of his presidential namesake.
Explosive end. Hint.
James Morrison.
Bob Reagan. I don't know.
That's Bill Buchanan from 24.
Oh, okay.
All right, our last question for Tara.
Yep.
Our laziest president, he was shot in the back, presumably on a Monday, but hopefully after a large helping of lasagna.
Garfield.
Garfield the cat from Garfield and Friends is correct. And that is regulation. Let's get the final scores, please, Tara.
It was not close.
No.
Adam finished with 7. I had 9. Sarah D. Bunting is our victor with 14.
All right.
Thank
Sarah
you,
D. Bunting.
Thank you.
I only had 24 questions, so I'm glad it's not a tie. If it was a tie, at the last minute, I thought, I'll just do an electoral vote, and somebody will just win, and it'll be very unfair. So I'm glad this is the way it worked out.
Sarah.
Well done, Sarah.
Indeed.
And thank you, Trivial thank Pursuit you. 90s edition, apparently.
Yeah, really.
It's nice to have questions we actually live through. Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We checked the scales on CBS's remake of The Equalizer before going around the dial with stops at Framing Britney Spears, Married at First Sight, Big Family Cooking Showdown, and Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. Adam Sternberg made the successful case for Succession's Safe Room in the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time from Corey. Next up, it's Freaks and Geeks on Extra Extra Hot Great. And on the next EHG Prime, it's Clarice. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
What did that turkey just say?
Sarah D. Bunting.
Lester touched all of us.
And Adam Sternberg.
I read Mein Kampf a couple of times.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Grit.
Thanks for coming. Enjoy the park.
What was that?
I said, gobbledygook yourself.